Kreisky-Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
Okay, guten Abend. Wir freuen uns sehr, dass Sie zu uns gefunden haben an diesem an dieser hoffentlich sehr spannenden und aufschlussreichen Buchpräsentation von Munira Kayat, who is joining us today from New York. Welcome, Munira.
Thank you.
I switch to English now because Munira does speak a little bit of German, yeah, we have learned today.
Yeah.
But still, it's easier to communicate in English, if that's okay for everyone. Munira is currently teaching at the American University Abu Dhabi in New York, at New York University in Abu Dhabi, but based in New York. And before that has been teaching at the American University in Cairo for 10 years. And actually, both of us, we met in Beirut, Lebanon, where we both conducted research and wrote our PhDs. Munira working on the southern villages, the villages of South Lebanon, me working on Palestinian refugee camps. And she was also teaching there at the American University in Beirut. But the reason why we have Munira here today, and I'm very honored to say there couldn't be a more timely and important event to present this book of Munira, The Landscape of War, because as the world is gloomy, has its eyes cast on the horrible events in Gaza, of course, and is waiting how the situation in South Lebanon is developing, whether we are seeing a second front opening up. Munira is taking us precisely to those border villages in South Lebanon on the border to Israel that have been living through the various stages of the long and ongoing war between Palestinians and in the struggle over Palestine, for which Lebanon has always been a key battleground. And one of the reasons, of course, is that ever since the Nakba in 1948, 100,000 Palestinians fled to Lebanon and other Arab nations, which turned Lebanon into a key space where the struggle over Palestine has been fought ever since and continues to be fought, creating a situation really where the history and trajectory of these two struggles, as for the rest of the Arab world, the unresolved Palestinian question has remained a constitutive force for the political lives of everyday citizens as much as for armed groups in the region. And the key contribution that this wonderful book makes and Munira has made with her research in the villages of South Lebanon is to take us beyond the front lines, to really show us and give us insights and share stories how this ongoing waves and various stages of escalation are lived and experienced and felt on the most on the level of individual families, of individual life histories, beyond the rhetoric of armed groups and militias and whatever we are hearing in the mainstream media about it. And so it's precisely on that note that I think it's very timely to have Munira here to open up a scene what these particular difficult moments for the people in Gaza for sure, but equally difficult for the people in South Lebanon, look like, feel like, and how they are lived and experienced at this particular moment. And on that note, before we delve into the actual stories of your research, maybe we start off with giving us a little bit more insight, Munira, if you don't mind, about the history of this particular place, what South Lebanon's relationship is in relation to the conflict over Palestine, and how it actually unfolded on these very specific territories and sites along the border, along the Lebanese-Israeli border, historically, how it unfolded.
Okay. Thank you so much, dear Monica. Vienna is one of my home cities or homelands. My family came to Austria numerous times during the Lebanese War, which spanned almost my entire childhood. And Austria was a place of refuge for us time and again, and continues to be so. Actually, for the last year of the Lebanese Civil War in 1989 and 1990, we were living in this neighborhood. So it was an amazing return tonight. I haven't been back in a very, very long time. So it's really, really beautiful to be here. Thank you so much. So a quick shift now to the landscapes of war of the Lebanese South. As we all know, these conflicts don't come out of nowhere, and where one begins is always a little bit arbitrary. So where we will begin in history, but it's really important to note that the landscape of which we speak is what we know, is the landscape that we know as Galilee. It is famous from the Bible. It's a landscape that is also referred to by the Shia population who live in these areas. It's a multi-religious area, but they refer to it as Jabal Amil. Historically, during the Ottoman era, it was known as Jabal Amil. And when it was established as the southern borderland of the nation state of Lebanon, that was established first in the aftermath of the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I, and then with the advent of the French and the British to the region after the Sykes-Picot Agreement, a borderland was drawn that sliced Galilee in two. And the northern parts of Galilee are what is now known as southern Lebanon, and the northern and the southern parts of Galilee are now in Palestine and occupied Israel. Israel and occupied Palestine, excuse me. So this borderland is an arbitrary, I mean, the border is an arbitrary line that has divided this sort of continuous landscape. And the people who live in the villages there are a mixture of religions. We're often sort of, when we think of South Lebanon, we often tend to think of the area as being dominated by Hezbollah and as being mostly populated by the Shiite religious group, which is a sect of Islam. But the area is also, there are many Christians there, in the villages, mostly Maronites, and in the towns, Greek Catholic, and we also have Druze. So it's a very religiously mixed area, demographically speaking, as is all of the region, really, and Lebanon in particular. So the border was first drawn in 1920 when Greater Lebanon was established by the French. The French and the British were establishing their areas of control, and the British said, okay, this is our part, and the French said, this is our part, and they said, okay, well, we're going to draw the line. And it was an arbitrary line that was drawn, but it was really sort of like often between villages that separated the end of the Shiite presence in South Lebanon, that became South Lebanon, from what became northern Palestine back then. And then the border was very amorphous, but what happened at this moment when the nation states were established is that the networks that connected the coast to the hinterland, right, which had families and trade networks and religious communities united through this region, were severely truncated. And so it was a moment of impoverishment, let's say, for many of the communities that inhabited these areas. People were cut off from their livelihoods, from their families, and from the landscapes of their lives. Okay, mm-hmm. So in 1920 until the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. When the Nakba happened, when the Palestinians were kicked out of their villages in Palestine, and the border became one between Lebanon and the nation state that became Israel, and this became no longer just a border where people could wander across at will, but a border that really defined a front line of warfare between one nation state and the other. So 1948 is really a foundational moment in the history of South Lebanon, because it hardened the border, but also created the condition of war under which people in South Lebanon continue to live. So this is an extended sort of period that is now, you know, well into its seventh decade, right? And people who live in this area are mostly, I mean, of course, the towns were no longer viable in terms of trade networks, so most of the people who remained in South Lebanon were people who were working the land. So it's agricultural villages, people who live off the land, and the biggest industry that people, or the agricultural crops that people cultivate in these areas are tobacco, for the tobacco monopoly that was established by the French colonizers, the French mandate, that was then nationalized in, after the end of the Lebanese civil war. So it's owned by the Lebanese state. Mm-hmm. So the people who live in those villages are mostly tobacco farmers and goat herders, and they attend to their olive crops. So this is a sort of a very brief history of the area. Yeah. One last point that I want to bring is that in 1969, there were the Cairo Accords, which basically allowed Palestinian armed resistance in the land of Lebanon. And in 1970, there was the Black September massacre in Jordan that ejected the Palestinian armed factions from Jordan, transplanted them to Lebanon, and then South Lebanon became a staging point for the Palestinian liberation struggle. So the early eras of war in South Lebanon was dominated by the Palestinian struggle, and so many of the armed elements in South Lebanon have their roots originally in Palestinian resistance. So the history of Palestine, the history of Israel, the history of Lebanon are deeply entangled in this region, and it's one that is not very easy to parse into, good and evil, or let's say even coherent sides. People are often shifting. This is a border, but there are ways to cross it. And of course, the relationship of the Palestinian armed factions to the Southerners was very complex. And Hezbollah today, in many ways, which is now the dominant militant group in South Lebanon, it first learned, the people who are now really well-versed in the kind of resistant warfare that Hezbollah is famous for, started with the Palestinian armed factions in South Lebanon. So there's genealogies of war, genealogies of also inhabiting an agricultural place through seasons of war, and a war condition that continues seasonally to return to this region, and people try to live within it.
And I think one thing to add here, in terms of the entanglement of the history of Israel, of Palestine, and Lebanon, is during the 15 years of civil war in Lebanon, it included a period of Israeli occupation in Lebanon,
absolutely,
which has been defining for this particular, the South, and not least for the birth of Hezbollah as becoming kind of the front force of resistance in this particular area.
Right? Absolutely. In 1978 was the first invasion of Israel to Lebanon. It was called Operation Litani, and it was a limited invasion where the Israeli army entered the southern borderland in order to eject the PLO and the Palestinian military elements out from the border region. But what happened is they invaded, but then they stayed. So from 1978 until May 2000, this border area where I did my research and where that I call South Lebanon, but of course South Lebanon is a wider area, but the area that the frontline area that we're going to be speaking of tonight is a 10-kilometer deep, 60-kilometer wide stretch of borderland. Just keep in mind that Lebanon is a very small country, but also high elevations. You know, we have big mountains in this area, and it was occupied for 22 years by Israel with the assistance of a local proxy militia that was also established in 1978. And this area is called the border strip, Shrit al-Hududi, or the occupied border strip, Shrit al-Hududi al-Muhtal. The Israelis often refer to it as their security zone. In May 2000, there was a second invasion in 1982, and this one reached all the way to Beirut. And the PLO was kicked out of Beirut at that time, but the occupation remained. And so, in the aftermath of the second invasion is when Hezbollah started to emerge as an armed military resistance to the Israeli occupation. And it moved from being a Palestinian resistance to a Shiite resistance that grew out of the violence of the occupation in South Lebanon. So this is also a theme, I think, that is worth thinking about, how oppressive occupations create the environments within which armed resistance, is born. So in May 2000, the Israeli occupation collapsed because of the years of very successful resistance by Hezbollah in South Lebanon. Mm. But in my book, I look beyond Hezbollah. Yeah. So.
So we don't want to delve further into, but I think it's important to understand, because even if I'm invited on the news to comment on whatever, then Hezbollah is called a militia. It's not a militia. Yeah, victory of 2000 and ending the occupation is a defining moment, mm-hmm. that since these groups have taken on a life of their own, mm-hmm. undisputed, but like you say, we want to look beyond or behind the political, the militant posture and political rhetoric of Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. But here I wanted to ask you, the last open confrontation, open war, armed conflict between South Lebanon or Lebanon and Israel was 2006, mm-hmm. of course, after Hezbollah hijacked two Israeli soldiers, mm-hmm. Underestimating the escalation that would follow. Mm-hmm. In any case, this short-lived confrontation resulted in, I think, 1,000 civilians mm-hmm. dead, but also major environmental effects of aerial bombardments, mm-hmm. including a major oil spill destroying one-third of the Lebanese coast, leaving behind millions of landmines, unexploded devices, mm-hmm. Which is particularly harmful, of course, for an agricultural community. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, the mines are still not cleared yet, and the trauma of this aerial bombardment, day after day, entire villages and areas wiped out and having to be rebuilt, sits very deep. I've been in Lebanon between 2007 up until 2020 on a regular basis and lived there for 10 years. This 2006 war sits very, very deep. And I wonder, in this current moment, how do these prior events, 2006, the period of occupation, how is that kind of affecting how a situation like the one we are seeing today is lived, felt, experienced, is shaping people's expectation and responses to the situation?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, people live war as seasonal, so they always live with the expectation of another war. So war is always on the horizon. So people live with this. So one should also always keep in mind that the struggle to live is one that is often tied up with the expectation that there will be episodes of devastation and death, right? So in the current moment, if I were to speak to the current moment, there's extreme, it's been an interesting sort of suspended moment where events are percolating on the southern border in Lebanon, and every day there's a bombardment, exchange of fire, and people are not really sure how things are going to unfold. It's extremely nerve-wracking. People are extremely fearful, but also it's not something that they're not familiar with, right? So really, it's been sort of like people have been waiting for it to explode, and it hasn't yet. And so there's this expectation of, we don't know what's going to happen. So many people have had a moment to prepare. And there are many people who have adamantly refused to leave their villages, but there are some people who are really tired of these cycles, and many of them have left. I'm subscribed to several WhatsApp groups. This is how I get most of my news, that basically reports all the episodes of exchange of fire. And really, I mean, on a daily basis, there's a lot of altercations. There has been a couple of deaths on both sides of the border, mostly military people, and there's been one Lebanese journalist who was killed maybe on the second day of the conflict.
Yeah, I think it's 35 even now, 29 Hezbollah members, mm-hmm. and 4,000 people are deciding to leave.
Yes.
But on this note of insisting to stay, mm-hmm. even in these suspended moments where you don't know which way it's going to go, I think that's one of the powerful contributions of your that you make in your book, how in this inherently explosive and dangerous mm-hmm. and potentially life-threatening landscapes where you never know, are you going to live the next day? What drives people to hold on and stay mm-hmm. and not give up their land?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a child of war, and I grew up in war. And the first thing that I was aware of in my world was war. I was always promised that the world would be become one of peace one day, and everything would be better. But as you can well see, regionally, it really hasn't gotten better. So in the absence of a better tomorrow, people need to really live today. And so people make the decisions that they make vis-a-vis the level of threat that the impending war or the threatened war will bring to their lives, based on what do they do in order to pursue their life here today. So if their life is tied up with their crops and with their trees and with their homes and with their plants, and if this is where they're bringing up their children, it's really, really hard for people to make the decision to leave, because if you do leave, there's always the fear that you can never come back, right? And so living on the borders of Palestine is a very, there's always the reminder of what happens when you leave, right, in South Lebanon. And so really people in South Lebanon have this very sort of resistant practical philosophy, or ecology as I call it, of trying to stay through all circumstances. And it's been quite a successful approach, one that of course is full of suffering and devastation. I mean, South Lebanon has suffered a lot through the 70 plus years of this ongoing conflict, and will continue to do so. But after generations of people are often sort of looking at how to how to plant the ground and how to rebuild their homes. And it's not just an empty rhetoric, really. It's truly, if you leave and if your home is destroyed, then the chances that you will never be able to come back is a real one, and they know it, right? So they try to stay rooted as much as they can. And the way that I describe it in my work in this book, and from what I learned through living in South Lebanon through those years, these really spectacular episodes of war are resisted by ordinary people through ordinary means, right? So if you have like a little kitchen garden outside of your home, the possibilities of you surviving through episodes of conflict is going to be higher, rather than if you abandon your garden and your garden dies, then the chances are that you're not going to be able to sort of survive there over the long term. So these kind of ordinary cultivating, caring, nurturing, life-making sort of ecologies and networks are what enable people to live through these worlds. And so Monica mentioned the ordnance, the explosives that are sprinkled across the agricultural landscapes of South Lebanon. There are around 400,000 mines planted in the landscape of South Lebanon, and there are about a million cluster bombs that are in the landscape. The mines are planted, they're dug in the ground, but cluster bombs, and maybe you've been hearing about this in the context also of the war in Ukraine, are devastating objects, because they're thrown over civilian areas in big canisters, and many of these cluster bombs are old stock of bombs. The ones that the Israelis use in South Lebanon were actually given to them by the U.S. They were used in Vietnam, and they didn't need them anymore, so they handed them over. And so they fall. Some of them explode, but some of them don't, and they are you don't know when it'll explode or not. So they stay in the landscape, and they nestle, and they become de facto landmines. But they're very erratic. An actual landmine needs you know, wait in order to trigger it, a cluster bomb can be triggered by any movement, right? So it creates an atmosphere of deadly, I mean, a reality of deadliness, but also an atmosphere of fear towards the landscape that gives people life, because in situations of extreme uncertainty, it's the land that always remains, and it's the land that people fight for. So these, I mean, the Israelis know this, and it's a kind of an environmental war that really sort of like seeks to make, you know, environments unlivable so people can no longer live there, because they do know that militarized resistance is premised on the presence of ordinary people living in these worlds, right? So those explosives are present in people's lives, but people find ways to live with them. So cluster bombs are difficult. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
No, on that note, in this highly explosive landscapes, I think you beautifully describe a whole new alliance of solidarity and mutual support and mutual protection emerges. Yes. Can you describe for us how this has created a special relationship between people and the animals and even village communities?
So one of the things that I try to narrate in my book, in this understanding of landscape of war, is to widen the frame of war to encompass more than politics and men with guns, right? So often, as we're witnessing now in Gaza, it's more than just militarized sides who are caught up in the crossfire and who are struggling to live and who are often dying, right? So how often we're so captured by the spectacular dimensions and the devastating dimensions of war that we forget to notice that there are real people in these worlds. So the question for me is what are those real worlds, those real people living in real worlds within these real conflicts? And how do we describe them? And how do we even access them beyond the militarized frames? And so in South Lebanon, I mean, I grew up in war, and I was very familiar with the tropes that people often take when they narrate war. And I really wanted to avoid that in trying to describe the ways in which people inhabit this landscape that has been a battlefield for generations and decades now, beyond just the militarized dimensions of it. So I went about asking people, like, how do you live here? What is your life about? What do you plant? What do you love? Who are your friends? What do you depend on? And I got really great stories from the people, and I observed, with my own eyes, the multi-species like survival collectives that not only goes beyond men with guns, but also beyond humans, right? So you can't really think of a world of war as only a world. I mean, like right now, we're recognizing that that we are vulnerable as humans on this planet because we are destroying its ecosystems. War is an ecosystem that is destructive of the capacity for life, and people resist it by actually reinforcing their alliances and their relationships to beings beyond the human. So in South Lebanon, the main ecologies that I focus on in my book are tobacco farming, they call it the bitter crop, because it's also a capitalist cash crop, and so it's premised on modes of exploitation and extraction that isn't very rosy. But still, the tobacco plant is a plant that thrives in arid landscapes, and is very hardy and doesn't need a long time in order to reach full maturity to be harvested. So its temporality is very fast. So it works within situations of war where you can't really invest in trees or in expensive livestock in the case of war. So tobacco is very has a good synergy with war worlds in terms of its temporality and its hardiness and its desire to be cultivated by many hands. So, I mean, poverty creates the situation where you have large domestic units with women and children, and these are the people who are working these crops. So tobacco is one of the backbones of the area that really allows people to live through these through these seasons of war. And the other alliance or survival collective that I focus on in my book is the human-goats relationship. So goats are also a very hardy life form. And the interesting thing about goats in South Lebanon is because this landscape is so infested with explosives that you can't really have heavy livestock in this area. But also, many lands have been abandoned, and there's very luscious, like, you know, grasses growing in areas where people don't go because they know that those are minefields. But goats are very light. They're four-legged, and so each footstep of theirs is quite light, and they don't trigger landmines. So they're often herded by their herders through the minefields in order to make use of the luscious grasses. And so they've reclaimed these areas, which are like fields of death, into sort of a capacity for sustaining life. Of course, goats are also animals that are not pets, but are used for mainly for their milk, but also for their meat and their manure, right? And so they're extremely sort of important to sort of sustaining the livelihood or the livelihoods of the people in the region. I mean, those are the two main ecologies that I look at.
Yeah. On this note of ecologies, can you maybe elaborate why this concept, what this called? Did you actually start off with, I'm taking a broader view, I'm mm-hmm. looking at the environmentality mm-hmm. of war, mm-hmm. Its ecological material dimension, mm-hmm. or was this something coming out of your observations, and how do you really understand ecology in this mm-hmm. context? Mm-hmm. What's a resistance ecology yeah. for you?
I wanted to write about war. I always wanted to write about war because it was something that I grew up in. But by the time that I was working on my PhD, war had receded into it was not immediately accessible. The 2006 war happened as I was writing my PhD, so I consider myself unfortunately to be one of those war profiteers in the sense that it really sort of brought war back into focus. For me to be able to write about it. And I did my field work in South Lebanon in the aftermath of the 2006 war. So I was literally, revisiting these devastated landscapes, but not asking about death, but rather about life. And I really wanted to figure out, there was so much celebration, and even in the aftermath of this devastation, a celebration that we are still here, that we have survived, that we continue to live. There's a resistant sort of, attitude towards surviving these cycles of violence that we can, observe just by looking at the wars that are taking place around us right now. So really, shifting the frame from death to life within the framing of war is one that I do for several reasons. One is that I really want those who are not accustomed living in war to be able to grasp the ordinariness of life within these conditions. So war, ever since the end of World War II in Europe, war was formally, let's say, ended, right, in the global north. But war didn't really end, as we all know. War was mostly out, it became, from World War II to the Cold War. But the Cold War was not very cold in many parts of the globe, right? There are very many hot wars, and the war, Vietnam being one of them, the Korean War being one of them, etc. But also the war that I grew up in, the Lebanese Civil War, which is and is not the Civil War, was also one of those fault lines of the contest between the US and the USSR. So I really wanted to shift the optics to life in order to show those, people who inhabited worlds that were considered peaceful and who had who had no immediate experience of what it is to live in war, that actually living in war is something that is imaginable and is also recognizable as sort of, the inhabitants of war are recognizable as fellow humans. The unfortunate sort of effect of war being outsourced to the global south is that people often think that these wars are endemic or are somehow tied into sort of the brokenness or the backwardness of those worlds, right? Without really paying attention to the larger global context, right, within which these wars are actually funded and unfold, right? So we have to think of the global connections, but also the humane aspect, the humanity aspect, the recognizability. So this is why I really insisted on a framing that was more inclusive, on the one hand. To get people to care about war, we can also sort of compare it to other structures that we have normalized in our peaceful northern worlds, structures such as the nation state and capitalism, and also to compare it to problems that we feel high anxiety about in the global north, for example, climate change, right? So, I mean, war is not an aberration of modernity. It's actually one of the pillars, right, that sort of establishes the modern world order, right? But it's one that, after the end of World War II, was really sort of like placed in other worlds. So the ecological aspect connects makes the humanity of those inhabiting those, war-seasoned world available to those of us who don't know war as an environment. Triggers our capacity to recognize that war can be grasped ecologically, right, as a sort of a process and not an event, right, that is destructive of worlds and that we can resist in the same way that we resist or try to resist or speak out against, life-ending realities such as climate change. Mm. And so that was why I insisted on the ecological dimension of it. And ecology also helps us, it's a good metaphor, but it also helps us pay attention. I'm an anthropologist, so we pay attention to sort of the ordinary sort of texture of everyday life. And in an agricultural landscape like South Lebanon, like I can literally say that people are, tending to the ecologies, right, that give them life, right, in order to resist the ongoing cycles of war. So it was a generative, metaphor, let's say, for me, but it was obviously more than a metaphor because I was speaking about actual ecologies. But ecologies actually opens up the relationality, right, that we have with other humans, but also that we have with the world around us. We all have to remember that we are dependent on other life forms on this planet, and I think one of the problems of humanity and why we're heading towards an unhappy, extinction event, is that humans think that they can live without other beings. It's a reminder that in these worlds of war, where people really can't even, guarantee that the sun will rise tomorrow, that they ultimately rely on other people and on other beings in order to optimize survival. So we can learn from these strategies that come out of these worlds of war that are not sort of exotic elsewheres that are, inhabited by people who are savage or barbarian, but they're people like us who are doing the best they can in destructive environments in order to, make life worlds.
And I think on top of that, what you also open up with this ecological perspective is a whole new layer and a whole new sphere of showing support, of showing solidarity, of enacting commitment to these lived realities of war in their everydayness and ordinariness and ongoingness. For us sitting here in the North or in Europe at least, beyond the institutional bunch of white men behind big desks negotiating dodgy peace deals or ceasefires that are not coming into place in the first place, right?
Absolutely.
So do you see a possibility for a different, more kind of a cosmopolitan kind of informal, I wouldn't even call it diplomacy, but solidarity to show with the people in South Lebanon, but even in Gaza and West Bank and Palestine?
Absolutely. I think, we have to understand that that resistance, right, is not simply an ideology. A resistance meaning that the resistance to death, the resistance to annihilation, the resistance to, you know, devastating and destructive politics, right, that we also, you know, experience in our, you know, cities and our, you know, comfortable lives, people who are struggling for wider alliances that could make our lives better within these rigid compartments that we think of as politics, right, today. So the resistant ecologies that this phrase that I coined, it really opens up beyond politics, right, to really see the worlds that that seek to create connections that enables people to live successfully, but that can also then potentially, you know, be emergent of a different kind of politics. And of course, there's a very feminist sort of like, you know, a trajectory or angle or sort of layer to this, because most of the, you know, the groups in South Lebanon that are really sort of like, you know, cultivating life, right, within this sort of like framework of men shooting at each other are women. Mm-hmm. But of course, the success of the resistant groups, let's say the resistance groups in South Lebanon, who today are Hezbollah, but have been a wide variety of groups, their success is premised on those more, I mean, of those women, of those children, of those people who live ordinary lives to support these militant activities. The moment that politics gets disconnected from this living register, it is no longer relevant, and it's also no longer possible. So, I mean, the guerrilla sort of like philosophy that a successful, a resistance should always capture the hearts of people for the militant to be able to swim, you know, through the people like a fish through the sea, is premised on these, sort of non-masculine, non-militarized elements.
And I remember even in the Palestinian camps, it was up to the point of the women being in charge of rebuilding the bombed down houses.
Absolutely.
Because the men were on the front.
Yes.
So it's not just the caring relationship and giving birth to children. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I was going to ask you how within the bigger theater of all parties involved in this war, how it nonetheless affects, despite all the nurturing and the vital role women have, how the recognition of this is playing out in the immediate context of a village, maybe, or even in the cult of martyrdom of the political rhetoric of Hezbollah and other groups.
I mean, unfortunately, I mean, most, even grassroots, political movements take on the horizon of statehood, let's say, or statishness, right, in order to sort of, the more successful they get, right? The heterodox and sort of more egalitarian origins of many political movements fades away as it becomes more entrenched in the political sphere. Hezbollah today is the resistance in South Lebanon, and so in South Lebanon they're referred to as al-muqawama, which is the resistance, but also muqawama is ordinary resistance, is what people refer to as their lives there in these regions. So there's a convergence of what people sort of recognize as their own capacity to survive through seasons of devastation and Hezbollah's ability to actually, you know, do successful fighting. But in the years since Hezbollah sort of really took over as the main actor and military force in South Lebanon, they have monopolized the discourse of resistance, the imagery of resistance, the practice of resistance. But within the villages, it's actually, when you go there, you realize that I draw on this idea of the gray zone, which was made famous by Primo Levi in his description of the concentration camps of World War II. But the gray zone is a space of extremity where it's not so easy to draw a line between friend and foe, right? Or those who have the power and those who don't, or friend and enemy, right? But in South Lebanon, I mean, in areas where war is ongoing or in spaces where conflict is real, people find ways to survive that are incoherent to us at a distance, right? We often expect that there are singular actors who are behaving according to a single ideology, and that this ideology is what propels their action. But in South Lebanon, actually, people are much more ambiguous about their, sort of allegiance, let's say, to the dominant power, be it an occupier or a group that is fighting for freedom, because they're actually mostly concerned with staying alive. Mm. So this was said to me by Timur Göksel, who was the spokesperson for the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon. It's called the Interim Force in Lebanon, but it has been there since 1978. And Timur was there until the liberation of South Lebanon. And when I was doing my fieldwork, I went to talk to him about South Lebanon, and he was extremely sort of committed to sort of thinking about the lives of people in these worlds underneath the sort of, very stark political categories. And he said to me that most of the, energy of the people who live in these villages is really geared towards survival. And it's really wrong to morally parse it, to say this was, this is a collaborator and this is a, a true, pure sort of like, upstanding resistance fighter. Because often these groups sort of overlap in ways that are really hard to make sense of in political terms. Mm-hmm. So politics is very reductive, and it's also very distorting of the realities of living in those worlds. And I think that would be something to think about when we think about politics, that actually, a space of dialogue, I mean, like the space, is actually very generative to imagining worlds where people can, find a way forward. Because it's often what happens when, agreements are reached is that one group, submits to the other, right? And then peace is called in the name of one group overpowering the other. But very rarely do we find pathways that actually encompass all sides. Yeah. Mm.